normally I would be glad to give a couple extra minutes for everybody to get settled. Unfortunately or fortunately, depending on how you read it, there's an awful lot to discuss tonight, and I'd like to get to it. As a result, there are some chairs over here. As a result, I am going to try to stick to the schedule. There is a sign-in sheet there, which I've asked Laura to make sure to pass around. Please make sure that you sign in. This will allow me to follow up on items that come up during the talk. Inevitably, things do come up, and I like to be able to email around afterwards about them. So please make sure that you sign in with a legible email address. And let's get to the topic. There is, as I said, a lot of material to cover. I'm going to do the best I can with it. Normally, I'm very glad to have questions and discussion during, but I think in this case, if we can limit the questions to where something really isn't clear, and then hold other questions until the end, I think that may be worthwhile. A disclaimer, I'm not a doctor. I don't pretend to be one. My knowledge regarding OCD comes from reading, not from any sort of counseling experience. And so, really, I mean, please don't extrapolate from anything I say. There are professionals who do take care of counseling people on things like this, and those are the ones who should be consulted. Practical questions really should go to expert counselors. What I'd like to do is to talk about the following. First of all, give a brief discussion of what is obsessive compulsive disorder, what is OCD, to talk a very little bit, about some of the methods of treatment, and then to move into a discussion of what is often called scrupulosity, or religious OCD, to talk about what some of the obsessions and compulsions are that are classically identified with religious OCD or scrupulosity, to talk about the true relationship between religion, Judaism and other religions, and scrupulosity, how we distinguish between religion and OCD, and to talk about some of the ways in which religion can contribute to OCD, and then to move into a discussion of recommendations for treating people who are observant of religion, Judaism, and frankly other religions as well, ways to treat them that may help treating a religiously observant person. There's an awful lot to discuss, and again, I'm going to do the best that I can with it. It's a very sensitive topic, and I hope to do it justice in the next 75 to 90 minutes. We'll see. I want to mention two books which I'm going to reference from time to time. One book, Religious Compulsions and Fears, A Guide to Treatment, which I think I could thank you, Robbie, for referring to me way back when, by Rabbi Dr. Avigdor Banchek, who lives in Israel and is an expert on the topic. That's an English one. And then the other one is a work called Eitzot V'Hadrachot, which is based on the advice given by Rabbi Yaakov Kanievsky, the stipler for dealing with issues of emotional health, and in particular OCD. This one is only available, to the best of my knowledge, in Hebrew, although I do have some translations on the sheets of material from there. Both of them are very useful. If you flip your sheets to the last page, you'll see there a bibliography of materials that I saw, except for two papers, which I know did not see because I can't claim to have seen them. But this is all material that's actually accessible and out there for those who want additional reading. The last item, the miscellaneous links, includes links to audio recordings of shiurim, of talks on OCD and Judaism. There's an awful lot of material out there for people. Okay. I'm turning to Rabbi Dr. Banchek's work, and I want to read to you excerpts from two scenarios that he provides of scrupulosity, of religious OCD, as I'm going to refer to it quite often. The first one is a little bit graphic. I apologize in advance, but this is the nature of what we're talking about. Chaim, a 19-year-old yeshiva student, would spend between 45 minutes to an hour in the washroom each time he had to relieve himself. He felt the need to go to the washroom more often than others because he had become hypersensitive to feelings in his bladder and his bowels. Any pressure, or the slightest hint of pressure, was a sign for him that he must relieve himself. Because of this, he would visit the washroom 8 to 12 times a day. Chaim's concern revolved around his doubts as to whether he was sufficiently clean to learn Torah or to pray. After he relieved himself, he would wipe himself excessively, which often caused bleeding. The long periods in the washroom were disruptive to his daily schedule, but it had the most devastating effect when he would go to the toilet at night before going to bed. This, together with some other nighttime rituals, could delay his bedtime until 3 or 4 a.m. This, of course, led to his waking up late, which in turn destroyed his whole daytime schedule. His friends in the yeshiva noticed it. One of them talked to his mashgiach, who is kind of a spiritual guide in the yeshiva, in an academy where Torah is studied. And the mashgiach then spoke with Chaim. He listened to Chaim's concerns of Jewish law, the need to feel 100% clean before prayers. He then made Chaim aware of the halachic requirements, the requirements of Jewish law in such cases, which he should follow. While Chaim verbally accepted the decisions, he would nevertheless misunderstand their meaning in accordance with his relentless doubts. If he was told one need only clean oneself 5 times, he interpreted this to mean 5 times after he had determined that he was already perfectly clean. This could in actuality mean that he would clean himself 60 or 70 times before he started his 5 countdown. That's one. A second case. Mrs. S., a 30-ish Orthodox housewife, developed complications in the area of kashrus, Jewish dietary law, not long after her marriage. She was particularly concerned with issues of milk and meat, and took the prohibition of mixing milk and meat to bizarre extremes. She would wash the cabinet and refrigerator door handles several times a day. When her young children would enter the kitchen, her anxiety level, already quite high, would jump several degrees higher, fearful that they would touch utensils, towels, etc. with unclean hands. Her way of resolving her plaguing doubts was to constantly wash her hands and have anyone who entered her kitchen do likewise. As a result, the skin on her hands became red, raw, and cracked. This in turn would lead her to fear touching dishes, lest the blood, real or imagined, from her cracked skin make the dishes treif, non-kosher. She would ask her husband to wash the dishes because she feared washing them with her bloody hands. She would avoid picking things up from the floor directly with her hands. She would either move it with her foot, or if she needed it, she would use a paper towel to, quote, protect her from touching whatever it was she was picking up. In short, for Mrs. S., the kitchen became a place fraught with potential danger. As a housewife and mother, it could not be avoided. It had to be suffered at great emotional cost. I bring these to frame what we're talking about, the type of suffering that we're dealing with here. I also bring it in order to distinguish between the colloquial way people throw around the initials OCD and clinical OCD. Meaning, especially with Passover coming and people cleaning in all sorts of extreme ways, people say, oh yeah, I'm so OCD, I wipe the cabinets 3 times. Like, there's a difference between somebody who is perhaps being more strict than they need to be and somebody who's suffering from clinical OCD, and that will become more clear as we talk. But I wanted to make sure to spell out what we're describing here, what we're dealing with. So what is OCD? So a very quick summary, which I pulled from the DSM-IV description and various papers that I read. I would ask that psychologists, therapists in the room who have added points or something to clarify, I want you to please contribute your thoughts. Don't hold them in. But this is what I have. And you can see on the sheets, I put a quick digest as sources 1 and 2 for obsessions and compulsions. Obsessions, first of all, it's obsessive compulsive disorder. So obsessions, as I understand it, are recurrent and persistent thoughts, impulses, or images that are experienced at some point as intrusive and inappropriate, causing marked anxiety or distress. They are excessive and unreasonable, not grounded in reality, and a product of one's own mind rather than someone else's conditioning. It's not that somebody told you you have to do X, it's that you tell yourself you have to do X. That's the definition I have for an obsession. The compulsion is a product often of the obsession. in which a person feels driven to perform a repetitive behavior in response to the obsession, to resolve and to quiet the worries by preventing some dreaded event or situation. I am obsessing over something, I am afraid something is going to happen, and in order to try to prevent that dreaded event from happening, I am going to engage in some kind of behavior which is supposed to ward it off. The problem is it doesn't succeed. Generally speaking, the compulsion is an unrealistic response to the situation. And when it doesn't succeed, the person feels a greater feeling of helplessness, a greater sense of anxiety, a diminution of self-worth. And they, as a result, they'll engage in the compulsive behavior even further, and it becomes a cycle. They may also engage in what are called avoidance behaviors, in which, to try to avoid triggering the obsessions, they'll stop engaging in various activities. And that may be the point where they come for help. So that Mrs. S, in this story, can't stay out of the kitchen. She has a family that she's cooking for. But an avoidance behavior may be to say, I'm so afraid of what's going to happen in the kitchen, I'm simply not going to cook. I'm not going to enter the kitchen at all. Or a person who is afraid of becoming dirty may say, I'm never going to ride public transit because I'm afraid of public transit. Because I'm afraid of becoming dirty, I should say. That sort of a pattern. So the obsession will lead to the compulsion, which will not help things, but in fact potentially make things worse. I'm going to pause for a second. The professionals in particular in the room, do you have anything to add or to clarify in those definitions? Okay, then we'll go further with it. General OCD, according to the studies that I've read, affects approximately 2.5% of the population. 1 in 40. That's the number that I've come across quoted quite a bit. Treatment approaches. This is not in any way, shape, or form a recommendation for any of the above, but treatment approaches include medication, psychoanalysis, behavior therapy, which basically, from what I understand, contend that OCD is a result of poor responses to natural intrusive thoughts, and by using learning theory, we can train people to develop a healthier response to their concerns. One particular method involved in behavior therapy is what's called ERP, exposure and response prevention, in which a person is exposed to the trigger for their obsessive thoughts, but they are prevented from responding with their compulsions in an attempt to get them to train themselves to actually respond differently. So in one example of it, a person who's afraid of becoming dirty might be taken to a subway station and have their hand put on the railing, and then they're not allowed to wash afterwards. That would be an example of potentially of ERP. We're going to talk a lot more about ERP later on. There are more terms to use, more types to discuss, but in the interest of time, I'm going to abbreviate here. I included some more terms on your sheets, but there's no time to go in great depth to them. There's also cognitive therapy, trying to solve the problem by helping people to respond intellectually differently to their obsessions, for them to realize that it's normal to have anxiety and worry, and that there are ways to cope with it. So that one popular method that I've seen referred to is called acceptance and commitment therapy, or ACT, using exercises to convince people to accept the thoughts that they have, to recognize that they are external and not personal, that it's not me, it's something that I have to deal with, and to get them to deal with it the way people deal with worries that they have. And then there's something called CBT, or cognitive behavioral therapy, which combines elements of cognitive therapy and behavioral therapy. Once again, I'm going to pause and ask the professionals anything to add or to modify about what I've said in terms of the modes of therapy. Okay. That brings us then to scrupulosity or religious OCD. If I were to take a poll and ask you this question, I think I know what the results would be, but I'm going to ask the question anyway just for fun. Do you believe that religion triggers OCD? I see some head shakes. Yes. I see a no.
You mean triggers de novo where the person wouldn't have otherwise had it?
Let's say yes. Let's say that's the question. Will it trigger it where someone doesn't have it at all, but religion itself brings it on? No? Okay. I'm not going to put people through heaven or shame, you know, to raise their hands for one or the other. But that, for me, would have been my assumption. As an uneducated person walking in, I would have assumed that religion, and particularly Judaism, perhaps Islam, with their focus on minutiae of religious performance, would, in fact, potentially lead someone to some kind of disorder like this. In truth, religion-linked OCD was first seen as a religious disorder in which people agonized about their own spiritual worth and compulsively performed rituals of penance and purification. The sport of retroactive diagnosis is a lot of fun, in which you take a historical figure and say, yeah, that person was such and such. So when you read about scrupulosity, religion-linked OCD, you find Martin Luther, the Puritan writer John Bunyan, Ignatius Loyola, the founder of the Jesuits, you find them all discussed as somehow having this scrupulosity. Of course, a lot of it is retroactive work, which doesn't necessarily recognize the culture of their time and the environment in which they functioned. Nonetheless, people like to say it. There's a lot of material on it. Interestingly, the word obsession itself comes from a word in Latin, which I'm hoping to pronounce properly, obsidera, O-B-S-I-D-E-R-E. And what it means is literally to besiege or to sit opposite. And it was the idea that there is someone sitting opposite you, particularly in a religious context, the devil, who is possessing you. So the idea of being obsessed was like being possessed by somebody. That's the origin of the term. But as we're going to discuss, the link between religion and OCD seems to function quite differently, according to the research that I've been reading. The most popular term used for religion-based OCD is one I've used already several times, and that's scrupulosity. Other terms that are used, Dr. Alan McLean Hamilton of the New York State Hospital for Diseases of the Nervous System coined the phrase theomania in an article that you can actually get online on Google Books. Then there's a researcher, Joseph Sirochi, who cites a French term, the doubting disease, which I think is particularly appropriate because that's what you see. It's self-doubt that's so operative here. Here are some very interesting numbers, which I've seen quoted in various papers. In Western cultures, 10 to 33% of those who have OCD have religious obsessions. Meaning, of that 1 in 40 in society who have OCD, 10% to one-third of them will have religious manifestations of it, and in some cultures, maybe as high as 40 to 60%. And it's a remarkably hard type of OCD to treat. Yes?
Those people also have other
effects. Oh, absolutely.
I don't know. My intuitive thing is that OCD is a disease. It's an illness. If you're religious, it can manifest in your religion very easily. But I don't think it's the religion that causes it, and those persons who have obsessions that if they're religious, the 10 to 30%, they are OCD people. They have the disease, and they'll probably have it somewhere else in their life as well.
So we'll get to that. I'm not there yet. Right now I'm just identifying percentages, and then we're going to get where we're going. Obsessions, I wrote in source number 4 on your sheets. Obsessions for people who manifest scrupulosity include a fear that one has sinned or is going to sin, a fear that by thinking something one has taken a vow to engage in some action or avoid some action, a fear that one has had blasphemous or immoral thoughts, a fear that God is punishing somebody or is going to punish them or those who they love because of that person's inadequacies. These are the obsessive thoughts. The compulsions include, and this is specifically some items that I've seen in terms of Jewish OCD, hyperattention to the words of prayer and to establishing proper concentration for prayer. So a person will be unable to start reciting the Shema because they're so concerned about other thoughts and am I thinking what I'm supposed to think religiously before reciting this prayer. Hyper-concern about washing one's hands, cleaning other parts of one's body, as in the case that we mentioned at the beginning. hyper-concerned about dietary law, but specifically in the area of cleanliness, like the contact between milk and meat in the vignette that I gave at the beginning, hyper-concerned about questioning God's existence and desires. That's technically more intellectual than a behavior, but it becomes a behavior because it's what the person devotes their activity to and all of their energy to. Worth noting, the particular obsessions and compulsions of scrupulosity may fit the contours of an organized religion, but a person can suffer from scrupulosity without actually being affiliated with a particular organized religion, meaning you can have somebody who does not identify with any religion, but they will have OCD with concerns about having thought something improper, having done something improper. It will have religious overtones without it being associated with any particular religion. So what is the relationship between religion and scrupulosity? So to my understanding, scrupulosity is not really religion. It's not really about religion at all. And I'll bring you a couple of pieces of evidence for this. First of all, OCD, and we're going to see a source on this in a little bit, does not bring a person to fulfill an entire body of religious law. It's not religion-wide. Meaning in Judaism, which has 613 commandments, you don't find OCD on the spectrum of the 613. Instead, as we're going to see, it tends to manifest on a small collection of behaviors which tend to fit and to match secular OCD. That's number one. Number two, OCD tends to cause fear and insecurity, and it's involved with fear and insecurity. The obsession causes the fear and insecurity. Carrying out the compulsion doesn't bring a person to feel more spiritual or closer to God. Meaning that people who deal with this, people who are washing their hands multiple times, they're not coming away feeling like, yes, now I'm closer to God, now I'm more spiritual. In fact, they often describe feeling like they're more distant. It's not a religious behavior. I want to make sure in particular to distinguish between scrupulosity and what may be termed bad religion. Okay, and what I mean by that is this. Religion may be, and I speak about religion in broad terms, not any particular one, but religion may well be maladaptive. Okay? It could be that certain religious behaviors are bad for a person's integration into society and normal, healthy functioning. It could be invent a religion. It could be there's a religion out there that says never shower or take a bath. That's maladaptive religion. It's not a mental illness. It's just it's a maladaptive religion. Religion may be poorly taught by its teachers. There could be a situation in which a person is taught to do things that are bad for them or that involve apparently obsessive thoughts and compulsive behavior. You know, for example, a person may be taught, and I'm making this up, and I'm making this up, and I say that a third time, I'm making this up. A person may be taught that they are required to make sure that they pry up the floorboards in order to make sure there's no chametz there before Passover. That's not OCD. It's bad religion. It means that you haven't been taught Judaism. It means that someone taught you something else. I want to stress that and make sure that that's clear. I came up with the following analogy, which I hope is correct. Scrupulosity is like somebody who is colorblind, in a sense, so that when they see something blue, they think it's red. They are driven by their worries to do things that are not demanded by their religion. As opposed to a person who was taught as a child that things that are the color blue are actually called red. If the child was taught the wrong name for the color, the child isn't colorblind, he was taught the wrong name. If a person is doing things that the religion doesn't really mandate, they're not OCD, they were just taught wrong. Two different things. Lauren.
Well, I think you said something really key a minute ago, which is that the behaviors don't relieve the anxiety. So if it was just following a religion like crying up the floorboard, then your anxiety about your kitchen being ready for Pesach would be relieved when you did that behavior.
Exactly.
But these people, their anxiety is not relieved.
Right, and I'm going to come back to that when I get to the distinctions between religion and OCD. How can you tell the difference? Because I think that's a key point. Thank you. What scrupulosity seems to be, and this is going to go back to the point that Dr. Justin made before, seems to be, and I'm basing myself on my reading here, an underlying anxiety issue that emerges in the context of religion. And here is a very important result, which I've seen in several studies. Studies show a similar prevalence of OCD across religious and non-religious cultures. The rate of OCD does not change. You may see religious symptoms among people who are of a particular religion, but the rate that I mentioned before, the 2.5%, is a constant. It doesn't matter whether you're testing it in Yerushalayim, in Jerusalem, or in the Vatican, or in Boston, Massachusetts. The rates are going to be the same across the society in terms of OCD. Scrupulosity will change. And here I turn to source number 6 from Joseph Cirocci. In his work, The Doubting Disease, Help for Scrupulosity and Religious Compulsions. I felt this was really better than any way that I could say it. He says, a superficial view may lead an observer to conclude, as do some mental health professionals, that religion is the source of scrupulosity. After all, a scrupulous man obsesses about sinning if he feels attracted to a pretty woman only because he believes this constitutes, quote, committing adultery in his heart. The superficial view fails to distinguish between religion causing the disorder from religion as its background. And here's the key line. Religion does not cause scrupulosity any more than teaching someone French history causes him to believe he is Napoleon. All human beings exist in some cultural context. Cultural backgrounds provide the scenery around which emotional problems create the drama. I thought that was a very potent way of describing this. There's a similar observation in source number 7. I'm not going to read all my sources aloud because we will never get out of here. But you can see it for yourself in source number 7. David Greenberg has written a lot. Dr. David Greenberg has written a lot on the topic and taken part in various surveys. Here you see the 10th chapter of a book called Current Treatments of OCD. It's their chapter. He didn't edit the book, but Greenberg and Whitston wrote the chapter, in which he says, obsessions of OCD appear to mirror the prevalent habits and values of a particular culture. If you live in a religious culture, that's what you're going to see. He says, after SARS, so you saw a greater manifestation of hand-washing and people obsessing about cleanliness to avoid contracting a disease. He traced it back also to the period after HIV/AIDS first surfaced. And there are two interesting confirming points for this. The first I mentioned earlier, which is that OCD does not surface on random points of religious observance. If you take a look at source number 8, again, from Greenberg and Winston, OCD symptoms of a religious nature are not found in all areas of ritual, nor necessarily in the areas of ritual most hallowed by the religion. In our experience with religious Jewish patients, for example, Sabbath observance is a very important feature of religious life associated with many detailed laws, but does not appear frequently among the religious obsessions of OCD in our clinic. We're not getting people coming in obsessing. I keep calling the Erev hotline. Is the Erev up? Is the Erev up? Is the Erev up? That's not what we're seeing. However, he says, or they say, cleaning the perianal region before prayer gets one line in the footnote of a latter-day code of Jewish law, but this ritual presents often in patients with OCD in our practice, like the first vignette that I gave you. The presentation of OCD in a religious context is less typically religious than it is classically obsessive-compulsive. It's a very important point. That's number one. Number two, most sufferers realize that OCD is actually detrimental to their religious observance, and they feel compelled to do it anyway. They will notice that because they can't get themselves started on their prayers because they're worried about what's going on in their minds, they're not praying, or they're not praying on time, or they're not able to get in all the words that they're supposed to be getting in. But it doesn't stop them from doing this. It's not a religious behavior. They can see that it's not helping them. So how do we distinguish between religion and OCD? So some suggest that if it's harmful, it's not helping them, it's not helping them grow in their religion, then it's OCD. That's the suggestion that some offer. I brought you an article from OL in source number 10. The source you see number 9 is actually in the wrong place. We're going to come back to that. But in source number 10, I brought you a piece from OL where they talk about this. I'm skipping it right now. Some suggest that behaviors that are not normal for that religious community are OCD. So, for example, when the authority in Jewish law tells them what you're doing is unnecessary or even wrong, if they won't listen, that tells you it's OCD. That's what I've seen some suggest. But I prefer a test which I've seen described in a few different places by Dr. David Greenberg. It's source number 11. And the part I pulled, the version of it that I pulled here comes from his chapter in that book, Current Treatments of OCD. And he gives you 5 criteria, which overlap to a certain extent. Compulsions transcend requirements of religious law. There's what the law requires. The compulsion is making them do something that the law does not require. Compulsions have a narrow focus on one area of religious experience. They're not becoming strict about everything. It's only washing, making sure I'm clean. It's only, are my thoughts the way they should be? Compulsions focus on something that is trivial to religious practice, but normal for OCD. That was like the line that we saw before about cleaning oneself before prayer. I shouldn't say that it's trivial. It is an important issue within Judaism. I don't want to downplay it. But comparing it to certain other areas which don't bother the OCD sufferer at all, it doesn't rank. Compulsions cause the patient to ignore or to be unable to fulfill other areas of religious law. And the patient repeats actions because of doubt, where law would not require it. And here I go back to the point that Laura made, that the patient continues to feel doubt. And doesn't the carrying out the compulsion does not relieve the anxiety. So that's what we're talking about in terms of OCD. Having separated religion from OCD, we have to acknowledge, or I believe we have to acknowledge anyway, that religion can play a contributory role. And here I refer you back to the source that's listed as number 9. 3 different ways. Number 1, religion can end up legitimizing the obsessions of the sufferer. By the way, before I forget, I don't know where the sign-in sheet is, but please make sure that people sign in, because I'm skipping things that I am going to want to follow up on by email. So the sign-in sheet is there. But if we could pass it around to make sure that people get it, that would be very helpful. Thank you. I can't offer any more direction than pass it around. Good luck. Okay. Legitimizing the obsessions of the sufferer. There's a phenomenon which psychologists describe called thought-action fusion, in which we treat thoughts like they are actions. You treat the thought, let's say a blasphemous thought, or a thought of I'm going to do something, as though it was an action. Now, from an outsider's perspective, one may say that's a sign of illness. But in Judaism, that's a very real issue. There are times in Judaism where thought is equal to action. So, for example, it's Friday afternoon, close to sunset, and I think to myself, I am now accepting Shabbat, and therefore I'm not going to engage in the work that I'm not allowed to engage in on Shabbat. That may well qualify, depends which authority you ask, surprise, but that may well qualify as an acceptance of Shabbat, such that I am now prohibited from engaging in various kinds of work. We have fused thought with action. So when the OCD sufferer is dealing with a problem which they are confusing their thoughts with their actions, and the therapist says, you thought it, but it doesn't matter, the answer is, well, in their religion, it may well matter. And that's going to legitimize for them the idea that their obsession is real and substantive and that it matters. And we'll get to the treatment part, but it can create a challenge. Further, religions that prescribe minutiae for performance of commandments, right, like Judaism, offer fertile soil for people who are tormented and worried about their inadequacy of living up to God's standards. If they know you're supposed to wash your hand before you eat bread, and you're supposed to wash to the wrist, and if the water goes past the wrist and then it comes back, then you have a problem, and dot, 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 that can make things very difficult for them. Religions that preach a harsh and punishing God may be more likely to encourage scrupulosity, or scrupulosity sufferers may, for themselves, as a consequence of their OCD, find that in their religion. You can look in Judaism and find sources that describe God as punishing, and you could find sources that describe God as merciful. But to someone who is obsessing, guess which sources they're going to pluck out? They're going to find the ones that confirm their obsession. Further, because OCD is tied to difficulty handling uncertainty, where anxiety springs up and they don't know how to deal with it, religions that say that a human being is naturally flawed are going to encourage that. There's a classic verse in Kohelet in Ecclesiastes, which most people view as comforting. It says, "Adam ein tzadik ba'aretz asher yaseh tov v'lo yecheta." There is no human being on earth who only does good and never sins. And usually that's a comforting statement, like, don't feel bad, we're all in the same boat. But to the person with OCD, that's a horror. I can never be perfect. I'm never going to get it right. It's a very frightening thing. So that's in terms of legitimizing the obsessions of the sufferer. It also complicates diagnosis, because we talked about how do you distinguish between healthy religious fervor and obsessive compulsive behavior. It's not simple. And further, religious beliefs may lead people who aren't sure to consult their clergy instead of consulting a doctor. Now, clergy who are wise and or experienced are going to understand their limits and say, I can't treat this, I can't diagnose this, they need to go to an expert. But there will be people who will say, I don't want to take that extra step. Yes?
And my experience has also been that they will, Rabbi Shaw, for someone that will acknowledge that their scrupulosity is part of the religion.
You got it. 100%. We're going to come back to that. That's a key point that we have to discuss. So hold that thought, please. But the phenomenon of rabbi shopping is very big in this. The religion may also complicate and challenge treatment. For starters, because they may have trouble accepting the idea that they're going to go to a doctor for assistance, but also because some practitioners of ERP, of exposure response prevention, may expect of them that they do things that they feel they can't do religiously. So, for example, and I'm going to come back to ERP later on, but for example, their anxiety is about the potential for mixing meat and milk in their kitchen. So the therapist says to them, as your exercise, you know what we're going to do? We're going to take some butter and we're going to put it on your meat silverware. It's not going to happen. The patient is going to be so upset and so aggravated, they're not going to come back. They're not going to have further treatment. Now, whether you're allowed to do that in the interest of treating this is something we have to discuss. Is it even needed for ERP is something I also want to discuss. Right now, I'm just pointing out the complication. Further, patients from a religious background may prefer medicine over behavioral treatment simply because it's less complicated for them. If you give me medicine and I feel better, then I don't have to worry about all of the religious issues that come up. But it may not be what's best for the particular patient. And finally, some argue, and I say some, that a rabbi who is orthodox is not going to understand the issue and won't be as lenient as he needs to be and so on. I will tell you that the evidence that I have seen is entirely to the contrary, but the claim is made. So, treating observant Jewish patients who have OCD. There is a fantastic paper. It's one of the papers that I list in the bibliography. You can see I reference it here in sources 12 all the way through source 21. Every single source there is pulled directly from this paper, Treating Scrupulosity in Orthodox Jews, from the Journal of Clinical Psychology, written by Hubbard C. Van Kushner. It is fantastic. Just an absolutely remarkable read. And they give you basically two broad recommendations for psychologists, some of which appears in other papers as well, but they do a really good job of collecting everything. Number one, know what your patient believes and trusts. You need a therapist who understands what Judaism is about and who understands even the laws and culture of Judaism. Number one, to enable diagnosis. Take a look, please, at source number 12. very simple point that they make, obvious once they say it. Appropriate behavior is environmentally determined. And just as healthy surgeons wash their hands relatively often, it may be the case that people in certain cultures or religious groups are slightly more bothered by intrusive thoughts. It's just reality. So in other words, just like you wouldn't say to a surgeon who washes hands all the time, that's obsessive behavior, you wouldn't say to a Jew who said, I have to wash my right hand first and then my left hand, that's obsessive behavior. It's not. It's part of the protocol for hand washing. You don't like it, you want to call it maladaptive religion, feel free. But don't call it OCD. So the therapist needs to understand what is considered normal behavior. It's also important, though, in terms of enabling treatment. One of the key points that I see mentioned by various psychologists is that you need to help the patient identify the core fear. Meaning, your patient who is worried about mixing meat and milk isn't really worried about mixing meat and milk. What they're really worried about, the anxiety behind it, may be a fear that God is going to punish them. That their relative who has cancer is now going to experience some deterioration. That's what they're worried about. They're worried about something in the greater world view, and this is only leading them there. If the doctor doesn't understand their culture, including their religion, how is the doctor going to help the patient to identify the core fear that they are experiencing? It's also important in terms of, and all of these correlate to sources on your sheet, I'm just not reading them aloud, but there's also the issue of avoiding a problematic recommendation, right? And in number 14, I'm not going to read it out, but you'll see it there. I talk about a particular problem in ERP in which the patient, as part of the treatment, is exposed to that which triggers their obsessive thoughts. The patient is not allowed to engage in their compulsive behavior. So the patient comes up with an idea, a strategy. I'm going to pray to God not to do whatever it is that I'm afraid he's going to do. The therapist doesn't want that, because the therapist wants the patient to learn to deal with the anxiety. So the therapist says to the patient, I want you to pray that God caused the harm. Try telling that to a Jew, to a traditional Jew. Pray to God to cause harm. It is never going to happen. So they offer, I think, a clever suggestion, that the person be told to pray to allow God's will. Whatever God wants to have happen should happen. Which is really code for, if it's going to be bad, it's going to be bad and I'll live with it. So it's allowing for the negative to happen without praying for it. It's the sort of thing that they're going to come up with because they understand where the Jewish patient is coming from. It's not something that others are going to be sensitive to. It's also important to understand Judaism in order to avoid dead-end tangents. If a therapist is going to get bogged down in a conversation saying thoughts are meaningless, they don't have weight, and so on, with someone who believes religiously and has been taught since earliest ages that what you think does matter, then it's not going to help, and worse, it's just going to bog down the treatment. It could even set the therapist against the patient against the therapist against the patient. You don't want that. It enables sensitive language. One point that they make that was fascinating, it's in source number 16, is that a therapist may want to discuss with the patient why we experience anxiety. If you're speaking to a secular patient, you may say to the patient, we evolved anxiety as human beings in order to deal with such and such. If you have a patient who is uncomfortable with the theory of evolution, and you propose that, you're basically putting up a big banner saying, I don't believe what you believe and I don't respect what you believe. It may not be true, but that's what you're signaling. So they offer, again, a strategy. Regardless of your personal beliefs, to ask the patient, why did God give us anxiety? Leave aside the question of the theory of evolution. That's a great topic, but we're not going anywhere near there for the rest of the night. But the point is to be aware of what the patient is believing and is thinking. It also helps, if you flip the page to number 17, to be able to quote Jewish sources. So, for example, they talk here about the idea of overcorrection. The idea of overcorrection is, if I'm bending too far this way, then I need to bend further past the midline in the other direction in order to come back to the middle. Which great Jewish thinker proposed that idea? Rambam. It's not original with him either. It precedes him. But the point is that if you can say to a patient, Maimonides talked about this, and this is a patient for whom that matters, you will get further. You will be able to help better. So that's number one, to make sure that you know what the patient believes and trusts. The second point is to offer a treatment approach that the patient is going to value. This is a very, very important point. Not to blame religion, and just the opposite, to make sure the patient knows that you don't blame religion. Take a look, please, on your sheets at source number 19. This is very key. They talk about what's called a treatment rationale. When you approach the patient and start outlining how you want to help the patient, you need to explain why it's important that the patient go through with their treatment. So, if you take a look at that number 19, they suggest here, by providing a sensitive rationale, the therapist can alleviate the skepticism and create an open therapeutic environment. For example, a number of patients have articulated, quote, if I just weren't religious, I wouldn't have this problem. Although not necessarily intended to test the therapist, a statement such as this creates an opportunity for psychoeducation and alliance building. One response might be, you might not have OCD about halacha, but you would likely have it about something else instead. You cannot run away from OCD. By saying that to the patient, you explain to the patient, first of all, something that's very important for the patient to understand, their OCD is not about Judaism. That's just the way it's manifesting. But number two, you show that you understand it as the therapist, and that you're not against their Judaism. And they don't need to have their guard up like this person wants to strip me of my religion in order to cure me of my problems. And that's a very important point. And add to that, source number 20. Source number 20 is an equally important item. Another part of the rationale for treatment that should be conveyed early on is that OCD is likely a barrier to the spiritual connection religious patients want to have with God, and that exposure response prevention can be a way to help them rebuild that relationship. In other words, if somebody is dealing with OCD, and they come to the therapist, and they have a fear inside that what the therapist is doing with them is going to reduce their religiosity, they're going to feel like treatment is selfish. The therapist who understands this is able to explain it's just the opposite. The treatment is virtuous. By undergoing this treatment, you are going to be better suited to be a healthy religious person. You will no longer be unable to recite Shema. You will no longer be unable to pray on time. You will no longer be unable to properly cook for your family and function as a Jew in a social environment, and so on. It's very, very important that the patient have that rationale for treatment, to feel like this is a good thing for them to do. Last point within this is to collaborate with clergy. That therapists should not be afraid to talk to rabbis. From my own experience in dealing with other rabbis on mental health issues, rabbis tend to be very sensitive and aware and willing and more than willing to help the patient through this. I hope that the therapist can agree. On this one, I'm not going to ask the therapists for their nightmare situations where it didn't work. But I will say that I know that there are rabbis out there who are very willing to help, and if anyone is in need of one, I can provide referrals. Like, that's very much true. Yes?
You made a passing point previously, but one of the foundations of Judaism is that we're all guarantors for one another, and that the actions of this generation are visited upon the next generation. How do you tell somebody that they're actions don't cause their relative to die or something, you know,
right?
Awful to happen.
Right, and that goes back to the point about how Judaism can, without causing OCD, can contribute to the challenge of treatment, precisely for the point that you're making. I made the point in terms of a different facet of Judaism, in terms of thought-action fusion, but you're making the point in terms of this idea of global responsibility and what I do can trigger something. So, I'm not engaging in treatment, but I would think that one key way to do it is to work with the patient on understanding the difference between an action which has religious weight and an action which does not have religious weight. And I'm going to come back to that. Remind me when I get up to the McDonald's test, and you'll see what I mean. Yes, Sharon.
Well, I think that sometimes, think about it from a psychoanalytical point of view, that a person who was religious and believed everything properly with religion, and then have something happens to them, it's devastating in some way, yeah. And they start worrying about it. Oh, but I did all the right things.
I'm not enough of an expert to talk about whether that could trigger it, but it's an interesting theory. I'm going to move on a little bit because there is so much to talk about still. I want to address a key point regarding exposure response prevention, because I mentioned before the idea that the therapist may say, hey, let's touch some butter to your meat silverware. My understanding, and I base this on the papers I've read and largely the work of Hubbard Steve Kushner, you'll see in the excerpt in number 21, as I understand it, ERP does not need, in many cases, to actually involve exposure to sin. The way that Hubbard Steve Kushner explained it, the fear is the issue. It's not the sin. It's the anxiety that comes about that leads them to take their extra steps to avoid whatever the sin is in the end. So take a look at source 21, please, the excerpt that I bring. They say, when treating religious patients, we believe it is not necessary or appropriate to include exposure to actual sin. Obsessional fears are usually driven more by actions that lead to increased risk than by actions that truly cause the feared consequence. For example, patients who are afraid of touching a book on AIDS, leaving the house with the oven on, or handling knives around their baby typically believe that these are risky behaviors, not ones that will definitely lead to the feared consequences. During exposure response prevention, it is helpful for patients to accept risks by acknowledging the possibility of their feared outcomes. But most individuals do not need to state that they are definitely going to get AIDS, burn their house down, or kill their child. Exposures do not usually require individuals actually to experience the ultimate negative consequences, but rather to tolerate risk. So they describe, and others describe, a path of treatment for a woman like Mrs. S, who's having trouble with the meat and dairy. And they may say to her, we want you to handle the tray that holds the butter, and maybe you want to wipe your hands on a napkin after, but you can't wash and then touch the meat silverware. There's absolutely nothing wrong in the context of Jewish law with somebody doing that. Every rabbi under the sun will tell you so. But that's an experience that will trigger her anxiety. And so that's something which could be engaged in without going the length of, I need this patient to actually experience the sin. I'm not saying that's true for all cases. I'm not saying that every therapist believes it. But I think it's a very important point for consideration. Having indicted Judaism as something that can potentially make it harder to deal with OCD, I want to now present for the duration of the talk unique ways that the structure of Judaism can actually help somebody with OCD. Generally speaking, in Judaism, one is not liable for inappropriate thoughts. It's true that we link thought and action, but we have an explicit Talmudic statement, Machshava Ra, Ein HaKadosh Baruch Hu Mitzarfa LeMaisa, that if a person has a thought to do something they're not supposed to do, but they don't actually do the deed, God does not view it as though they had gone through with the deed. We don't fuse thought and action. There's more to be said about that within Jewish law, but I'm scratching the surface here. Further, believe it or not, Judaism is designed to limit its obligations on a person's behavior. I realize that that may sound funny to some people. You can laugh. But it's actually true. I'm going to give you an example. Take a look at source 23. I'm skipping a little bit within the sources in the interests of time. This is regarding tzedakah. This is from the Code of Jewish Law, the Shulchan Aruch. Someone should please spread it to all fundraisers. Adam Shua Shenosein Tzedakah Yosei Meharo Ilo. If there is somebody who is a generous person to the point where he gives more than is appropriate for him, Oshem Meitzer La'atzmo V'nosein L'gabay Kedei Shelo Yisbayesh. He pains himself to give to the collector because he's embarrassed if he doesn't give. So he's going to make sure to give. Asur litov o l'ligbos mimenu tzedakah. It is prohibited to request tzedakah from that person. Ve'agabai shemachlimo b'shoel mimenu asir HaKadosh Baruch Hu lipara mimenu. If the gabai embarrasses him and asks him for tzedakah, God is going to punish the collector who does that. Meaning, you're not supposed to put someone in that kind of a situation. People are meant to function religiously in a healthy situation. We have a biblical verse. It's from Sefer Mishlei, the book of Proverbs. It's in source number 24, if I remember correctly. Derachea darchei Noam, v'chol nesivoseha shalom. Her ways, the ways of the Torah, are supposed to be pleasant. All of our paths are paths of peace. And that's a line that gets quoted repeatedly by rabbis who deal with this issue. Let's take a look at source number 25. Inevitably, people like to link, I mentioned this about half an hour ago, people like to link preparing for Pesach with OCD. However, this source denies it. It's talking about, this is a Talmudic source, it's the Mishnah, it's codified 2,000 years ago, roughly. And it says that when it comes to cleaning for Passover, I do not need to be concerned that maybe a rodent, in our society translates small child, took food from point A to point B to point C, so that I cleaned this place and then I went on to here, and maybe then the kids, you know, crept in with a Cheerio, and now there's chametz sitting there. That's not my concern, says the source. Source number 25. We're not concerned that a rodent may have dragged leaven from house to house, place to place, because then if you did that, you'd have to worry about yard to yard and city to city, and ein la davar sof, there would be no end to the matter. We do not deal in doubts that have no end. And particularly in dealing with doubt. We have a rule, safek derabanan lahakel. If one has doubt in a rabbinic matter, in a rabbinic law, he's always supposed to go leniently. Safek bracho lahakel. If a person isn't sure whether they recited a blessing they were supposed to recite, they're not supposed to repeat. They're not supposed to go back. The phrase in the Talmud, Lo nitna Torah l'malachei asharet. It's in source 26. The Torah was not given to the angels. You're not expected to be an angel. Source number 27 is one that I am going to read out. This deals with the laws of what's called chatzitza. There is a rule for immersion in a mikvah, that one who immerses in a mikvah must make sure that the skin is clean of any dirt or anything that would interrupt between the skin and the water. This, of course, comes up in terms of trips to the mikvah for a woman who's observing the laws of Nida. It also comes up for anybody who wants to go up on the Temple Mount in Jerusalem. For those who believe that one is permitted to go up on the mountain, they need to immerse first properly in a mikvah. Take a look at what Nachmanides writes regarding this issue of chatzitza, of the interruption on the skin. He says, I'm not going to read the Hebrew, I'm just going to read the English in the interests of time. It is not good to be overly strict, seeking doubts to disqualify or immersion for a light reason, for there would be no end to it. One should not insert his head into serious, interminable doubts, such as whether she closed her eyes too much or pursed her lips too much or other doubts. Who could evaluate whether she closed them too much or not? He says, come on. You're gonna drive yourself over the bend, off around the bend, and it's not warranted. That's not what Judaism is meant to be. Jewish philosophy is meant to be forgiving. I brought you a couple of sources on the issue of ones, that when one is compelled to do something, they're not liable for it. And Judaism has, or is supposed to have, a clear distinction between law and stringency. Unfortunately, not everybody gets that. And we do have, unfortunately, a certain cloudiness that some people have in figuring out where does the law end and personal stringency begin. But the sages were very, very careful when they wrote their codes of law to distinguish between the two, to make sure that the practitioner would understand where the law ends and the stringency begins. Take a look, please, at source number 30, where Hufford Stephen Kushner used this for what I referred to before as the McDonald's test. they talk about helping this patient to engage in a particular behavior that they're worried is wrong for them to engage in. And they write, the McDonald's test is useful. This is analogous to another test they call the gun test. But I like the McDonald's version of it in terms of scrupulosity. Is doing this, whatever activity it is, the same as going to McDonald's and eating a bacon cheeseburger? Often this can help the person gain perspective about the reality of what they're being asked to do. They're not being asked to sin, but rather to tolerate a small and halachically permissible possibility that they may sin. They're being brought into a position of anxiety and doubt. They're not being told to do something wrong. And Judaism, with the bright line it tries to create between law and stringency, should be suited to protect the person by explaining, this ain't McDonald's. This isn't the problem. And that's part of the job of the rabbi. Further, in Judaism, the individual's right to be strict is limited. An individual is not entitled to take on practices of arrogance and self-righteousness, or even that have that appearance. I brought you one example in source number 31. In a community in which people engage in melacha, they go to work on Tisha B'Av, there's a concern that the person who declines and says, well, I don't want to do it, is actually guilty of what's called in Aramaic, yuhara, arrogance and self-righteousness. We're not supposed to take on things that are going to make others look bad. We're not supposed to take on things that are going to make ourselves look like we're trying to be above others. And there's an emphasis on not taking on stringencies, which will in the end inevitably lead to leniencies. Every stringency can do that. Take a look, please, at source number 32. Rabbi Shabtai HaKohen, also known as the Shach, one of the principal commentators to the Code of Jewish Law, wrote a collection of rules for halachic authorities to follow. And this is one of his rules in source 32. Just as one may not permit the prohibited, so one may not prohibit the permitted. Just like I can't say mutter, allowed, when it's not, I'm not allowed to say asur, to say it's prohibited, if in fact it's fine. Because generally, he says, it's going to cause a leniency in some other area. You tell someone the food's not kosher, great, you are now guilty of bal tashchit. You threw out something, wasting something that was perfectly fine. You told someone they couldn't go to the doctor on Shabbat, well, you may be guilty of murder. We take this very seriously. We don't introduce stringencies inappropriately, and there's much more to say on it. I brought you more sources. Feel free to take a look at them. But Judaism is supposed to emphasize joy. Flip the page, please. I brought you two verses in source 34 which present an opposition. One verse that says you should serve God with reverence, rejoice in trembling, and the other that says serve God with joy, come before Him with song. And we have this tension between the two. On the one hand, we have to be reverent. We have to approach God with the respect appropriate for the Creator of the universe. And on the other hand, we're supposed to be happy when doing it. And this leads Rabbi Yaakov Kanievsky, who I mentioned an hour ago from this book, that leads him to a very interesting line in source 35. I want to stress now, when I have translations from Eitzot V'Hadrachot here, they're not my own. Because I ordered this book from an Israeli bookstore months ago, and it arrived 2 days ago. So I ended up pulling the translations from somewhere else because I didn't have access to the material. The other translations are mine, but I take no responsibility for those. In any case, take a look at source number 35. Rabbi Yaakov Kanievsky, the Stipler, and you will not find anybody more observant of Jewish law in the 20th century than the Stipler. You will not find, it's simply impossible. If you want to know more about him, actually pick up this week's Toronto Torah, which is going to feature a bio of him and a translation of some of his writings, or writings in his name, I should say, about the issue of shame and embarrassment over sin. He has some very interesting things to say there. But that's not the point. The point is, you're not going to exceed the religious character of Rabbi Yaakov Kanievsky. This is what he has to say about someone dealing with obsessions that drive him to compulsive behavior in Judaism. He says, such thinking is a tactic of the Yetzer Hara. The Yetzer Hara, that which inspires a person to sin. In order to make observance of the mitzvah so burdensome that he will eventually, God forbid, shirk the yoke of the Torah. You follow what he's saying? He says, as far as he is concerned, OCD is a tool of the Yetzer Hara to drive people away from Judaism. It is something that leads people away. It's not helping them become more observant. It's actually tearing them away. Judaism is supposed to be practiced with joy. Take a look at Source 36. Source 36 comes from Rabbi Yaakov Mordechai Grinwald, who was the one who put this book together based on the letters and comments of the disciple of Rabbi Kanievsky, and he writes, "The person who, whenever he performs the will of the Creator, finds his soul and his energies contorted by feelings of discomfort, fear, tension, and misery over the carrying out of the commandment. And on the contrary, this is his usual state. To carry out commandments out of joy is the exception. This then is clear proof that this was not God's intention." For he quotes a sentence, "Oz v'chedva bimkomo," in the Hebrew, "strength and joy are in his, God's place," meaning that the essence of performing commandments is joy. As Maimonides wrote, and he goes on the topic. Judaism is supposed to be about joy, not about anxiety. Very important to realize. Judaism should be, in the right hands, a tool to help the person with the OCD by pointing out that it's taking away from their religion, by pointing out that that Judaism is about joy, that thoughts are not, the thoughts of doing something bad are not the same thing as doing something bad. By making the distinction between law and stringency, Judaism can be a tool to help as opposed to something that makes things worse. And historically, rabbis have dealt with these issues in this way. There are many anecdotes floating around about how rabbis have permitted this and allowed that. I'm not going into those only because I only want to quote things that for which I can cite chapter and verse. Take a look, please, at source number 37. Actually, before 37, I'm sorry. I went out of order. No, 37 is right. 37 is correct. Never mind. The 37 comes from a very interesting pamphlet called Yirat Tahora, which is available online in the Otzar HaChachma database. Yirat Tahora is a pamphlet circulated in Bnei Brak in Israel, written with the explicit approval of Rabbi Chaim Kanievsky, the son of Rabbi Yaakov Kanievsky, who is the de facto and, well, almost de jure, really, leader of of what is usually called Haredi Jewry in Israel. And this is what is said here in Yirat Tahora, talking about getting treatment for OCD. They don't use the term OCD, they use the term nervin, which is a Yiddishization of nerves. So, nervin is what it is. "In truth, it is known to us," take a look at 37, "Omnam no dalanu, gam min amitzius v'gam me'anashem ha'oskim harbe besugya." He says, "In truth, it is known to us from experience and from those who are very involved in the field that no one ever had the nerves halt on their own without them declaring a war of destruction, a sacred war." He says, you have to battle this as a problem. "Also, one who neglects the issue due to laziness, failing to act, is," quote, "a colleague to the destructive person." Chaver li'ish mashchit is the statement in Mishlei in Proverbs. He destroys for himself entirely the structure of prayer. He's talking about somebody who doesn't get help for it in the context of problems that are manifest, compulsions in terms of prayer. He says you have to do it. And there's much stronger language all through this work. It's a short work. It's like 25 pages. The second point, rabbis know to be lenient in this. Take a look at source 38. Rabbi Yisrael Ganz is the Rosh Yeshiva of Yeshivas Kol Torah in Yerushalayim, in Jerusalem. He's also a fairly observant man, to say the least. And this is what he says in source 38. "In cases that come before you," he's addressing this letter to Rabbi Dr. Banchek, who's treating people with OCD. He says, "In cases that come before you regarding sufferers of religious compulsions, I think it is important to recall that which the Gedolei Yisrael, leaders of Israel, such as the Stipler Rav and the Gaon of Shlomo Zalman Auerbach and others have opined on this matter, that in every case of doubt in the halakha, one is to decide on the lenient side of the question. Likewise, even if it is unclear whether there is a doubt, one is also to be lenient," and he goes on within in that vein. He is very clear. He's very unstinting in his words, and there are many examples of this. So, for example, in the work Yirat Tahora, they talk about somebody who is afraid to start Shema, because he knows that the mitzvah reciting Shema requires that I accept God as king. And so he spends time trying to get himself into that frame of mind, and he's worried he wasn't there, and he starts the line, and he restarts the line, and restarts the line. And the work Yirat Tahora says, you know that if you do that, you're violating a different law, because you're not supposed to interrupt between the blessing that precedes the Shema and the Shema. So don't do this. You're not supposed to take all that time in order to get yourself into the mode of saying Shema. when it comes to the fellow we mentioned in the beginning, in our first vignette, this fellow Chaim, who was washing himself over and over and over again. So this goes back to, interestingly, Rabbi Nachman of Breslov talked about this issue. You're talking 150 years ago. And he prescribed, he said, so you wash a certain number of times, and that's it. No further, don't look, no nothing. Similar advice is given when women are concerned about nida, and they're worried that maybe they had some blood that may have made them a nida. This is beyond the scope. The laws of nida are beyond the scope of where we're going tonight. But the statement is made, don't look. Simply don't look. If you think blood fell on something, don't look. It is 100% acceptable halachically in most circumstances to say that. There may be a circumstance that's different, but generally speaking, it is 100% acceptable. And that's the advice that that is given. The Stipler himself, Rabbi Kanievsky, records in a letter, which is published in a collection of his letters, that he asked Rabbi Yitzchak Zev Soloveitchik, the Brisker Rav, a great and extremely pious leader of European Orthodoxy in the beginning of the 20th century, beginning first half of the 20th century. He was asked about somebody who is driven by obsessions to take vows. And he vows he's not going to go here, or he's going to do whatever it is. And his answer was, such vows are meaningless. There is nothing to them. They should not be honored. They are completely null and void. Very simple, very straightforward. That's the kind of response that we have because this is so crucial that patients be treated for this very destructive problem. Now, here's a really interesting thing, and this goes back to the point about rabbi shopping before. Sometimes the rabbi has to avoid giving reasons. If you take a look at source number 39, we're getting to the end. Source 39, Rabbi Yaakov Kanievsky says it is forbidden to give him reasons or explanations when you give your answer. For every reason that he has given, he will undermine, to contradict, and reject completely whatever he was told. You'll see it also in Source 42, jumping to there for a second. Rabbi Dr. Abraham Twersky wrote a foreword to this book. And in it he wrote, an OCD sufferer may not necessarily be reassured by the opinion of the poskim. Poskim are authorities in Jewish law. One woman with OCD threw out three sets of dishes because she could not accept the Rav's ruling that the dishes were perfectly kosher, saying the Rav did not understand my shaila, my question. That becomes very difficult to work with because Judaism relies on this system, and certainly when it comes to OCD, but in general we rely on the idea that there is an authority and you have a question, you consult the authority. This is how Jewish law is structured. So that's really makes it very difficult, and so we're told, and Rabbi Kanievsky stresses this, don't give reasons. This is my ruling. You ask me what the answer is, this is the answer, and then you hope they don't go rabbi shopping. Now, there are three hazards here. Hazard number one was really an eye-opener to me. I never would have imagined this. The rabbi has to sometimes refuse to respond altogether to the question. Take a look, please, at source number 40, where Rabbi Dr. Bonchek discusses this. He says, if on the other hand, he's talking about a woman who comes to the rabbi and says, I think that I saw blood, and she brings him a cloth, and she says, I think there's blood on this. If he, on the other hand, does not think there is any problem with the bedika, with this cloth, he should not give her an outright heter. He shouldn't say, don't worry, your cloth is fine. Don't say that. He should say something along the lines of, I don't answer such questions. She will pressure him to be more specific. But he should not budge from his one-sentence, non-committal answer. Now, lest you say, that's cruel, the rabbi should warn the woman before any questions come up that he will be giving her this kind of answer to her questions. She should know going in. He tells her, you have a problem. Your problem is dealing with anxiety. If I answer your questions every time, I'm encouraging you to keep coming back with these questions. That's not healthy. So what I am going to do is I'm going to tell you that I don't answer such questions until you understand that sometimes you have to live with anxiety. And that's the approach that he is counseling here. She should not think he's just being impatient or uncaring. He should not reassure her that bedika is clean. It is not to her benefit. Shocking, no? Am I the only one who looks at that and says, that was counterintuitive? To me, it certainly is. But that's his advice. Again, as I said in the very beginning, I am not an expert on OCD. I've done a lot of reading, but for all practical issues, you have to talk to somebody who actually is a professional who deals with this. They don't take anything that I am saying and do anything based on it. I know you know better than to, but I'm asking you that anyway. But take a look at Source 41. Another hazard of the rabbi system. This is also a very clever point. The patient is supposed to undergo ERP, exposure response prevention. The patient goes to the therapist. The therapist says, I want you to do X. The patient says, I can't. I can't do that. My religion won't allow it. Ask my rabbi. Therapist goes to the rabbi. Rabbi says, yeah, that's fine. You can do it. Easy. Therapist goes back to the patient and says, I asked your rabbi. The rabbi said, it's fine. You know what the patient now does? The patient now transfers the obsession to something else. Okay, so that's not my obsession anymore. Even if they accept what the rabbi is saying, even if they accept the idea that this is fine, they can go through with it, that's not going to be their obsession anymore. They've now, you know, you've now solved that, but you haven't solved the OCD. It's just going to move somewhere else. So that even the voice of the rabbi can actually end up being destructive. Take a look at 41. This is from that Hufford Steve Kushner paper. Ultimately, patients need to be willing to engage in the exposure and accept the uncertainty about whether it is permissible. The notion of accepting uncertainty and acting despite the anxiety is a guideline not only for a given exposure, but also for how OCD patients must live in general. They have to learn to do this in general, to live with anxiety. If you solve this particular anxiety for the patient by getting the rabbi to say it's fine and they believe you, you still haven't solved the OCD. It's about learning to live with the underlying worry. Last point within this is Dr. Tversky's point in that last source where he notes the problem of the sufferer not trusting the authority. There has to be a real relationship, and you have to hope that the rabbi shopping won't kick in, that the relationship will be strong enough to conquer that. Ultimately, it's very important for the community, not just the therapists and not just the patients and their families. It's important for the community to become educated in recognizing OCD for what it is and to refer to the person to someone appropriate who actually is able to help. The line was quoted before in a different context, Kol Yisrael Arevin Ze Bazeh, we are all responsible for each other. It's very hard to do this. And if a person feels that someone they know is, in fact, facing this, I don't necessarily recommend that you confront the person. You go to someone who is a professional, perhaps, and ask them how they would approach the situation. I think that's probably healthier, on a guess. But it's important to strive to help others. To do a 5-second summary of the last hour and a quarter. Number one, please make sure you signed in, and that's important. Oh, and I didn't mention in the beginning. I'm going to mention it now for those who are interested in this. If you're not, that's also fine. But there are cards over there on the table for what we call supplementary supporting membership, which means this program, like all the programs pretty much that my program, the YU Torah Mitzion Beit Midrash puts on, is free of charge. We are very glad to be able to do that. If people are able to take on a supporting membership for $36 a year, there's a card there. You can fill it out. You could also do it online. There's a link on there. If you want to fill it out and give it to me, that's also fine. And if you don't want to, that's fine too. And please continue coming to programs. No one is going to judge you. I'm just making the option, the opportunity available. But going back to what I was supposed to be summarizing here, after the description of OCD, in which we talked about obsessions and the compulsions they lead to, the obsession being the worry, the fear of something terrible happening, leading to the compulsion which someone does trying to solve the worry and settle it, which doesn't work. It doesn't help, and therefore they continue on in that pattern. We talked about some of the types of treatments for it, which I listed for you there on the page. Exposure and response prevention, where they're exposed to the trigger but not able to respond to it. Acceptance and commitment therapy, trying to help them to come up with ways to deal with their worry intellectually and emotionally. We talked about the phenomenon of scrupulosity, the obsessions of fear of sin, fear that you've taken a vow, fear of blasphemy, that you blasphemed somehow in your mind, fear that God is punishing or will punish a relative or someone oneself, and then the compulsions, hyper-attention to the words of prayer, to washing one's hands, to dietary law, to questioning God's existence. And what we suggested here is that scrupulosity is not really religion. We noted that the behaviors associated with it don't fit the spectrum of religious practice. They come from a very narrow band of practices, which are really more similar to OCD in general society than to religion, things like the hand washing. We also noted that it doesn't bring people to feel any closer to God. We also said scrupulosity is not the same as bad religion. If a person is taught to do things that are destructive and that's presented to them as religion, that's not OCD. It just means that they may be engaging in behaviors that are destructive. OCD is something different. It's this emotional difficulty or anxiety difficulty in terms of dealing with worry, dealing with anxiety. By the way, I should know, because I want to make sure that comes out right. I am not saying that it is entirely, so to speak, emotional and psychological and not biological. There's work that's been done on biological bases, and that's beyond the scope of what we're going to discuss, but I'm not saying that there isn't a biological element to it as well. I'm making that clear. How do we distinguish between religion and OCD? So I favor the 5-part test from Dr. Greenberg that was in source number 9 on your sheets, in which he talks about compulsions transcending the requirements of religious law, having a very narrow focus on things that tend to be trivial to religious practice, and the actions are repeated because of doubt beyond where the law would require it. We do say, though, that religion can play a contributory role by legitimizing obsession to the person through the focus on minutiae, through the thought-action fusion in which thoughts are given the weight that is normally given to actions, through the belief in a harsh and punishing God, through the belief that human beings do make mistakes. Shocker. Religion can also make diagnosis difficult, as it makes it hard to distinguish between religious fervor and scrupulosity. And it makes treatment difficult. Sometimes people don't want to go to a counselor. They rather go to their religious authority. They may also have difficulty understanding that the treatment doesn't violate their religious principles. In terms of treating Jewish patients with OCD, so we saw the recommendations of, number one, the therapist should know what the patient believes and trusts. That will make him a much better therapist for the patient. It enables proper diagnosis. It enables you to be on the side of the patient, to speak sensitively to the patient. It also helps to offer a treatment approach that the patient is going to appreciate and value. We talked about, as a side point, ERP treatment and Jewish law. I'm not going to go back into that right now. But we talked about ways in which the structure of Judaism can help someone with OCD. Judaism's emphasis on not straining somebody financially, physically, and dealing with doubt. The idea of forgiveness within Judaism. The distinction within Judaism between that which is law and that which is stringency, and the opposition to taking on excessive stringencies. And the emphasis in Judaism on joy. And the last bit, we talked about how rabbis have dealt with these issues and noted the tendency towards great leniency on it. The idea of avoiding giving reasons, lest the OCD sufferer simply take advantage of that as an opportunity to argue, and the hazards of rabbinic advice, whether in terms of rabbi shopping, they didn't like what this one said, so they're going to find somebody else who will justify what they're doing, as well as the concern that when you give your advice, you don't encourage them to ask more questions when it is inappropriate. There is, of course, much more to be said. This was, I hope, at least a start to it. I'm going to stick around to talk about this further, so please do come up to me. I have a conference call at 9:45, but until then, I'm safe. Please do stay afterwards. Again, I hope to email out follow-up regarding this, so I hope you signed in with your email address. Thank you very much. Have a good night.